I mean, I was convinced that I was going to convince these kids in my Bible classes to love the Bible, and through it, to love the God of the Bible. I mean, I was going to be that cool, relatable, young teacher who would win them over, and through a mixture of my riveting teaching skills and also some cool pop culture references that I sprinkle in there, I was going to make a difference, and I couldn't wait to get started. Until I actually started. By about day two or three, I realized that my students were not nearly as impressed with me as I thought they would be. They were not impressed that I had decided to put my grad school plans on hold to come teach them for a couple of years. They had had many teachers before me, and sadly would have many teachers after me, who had been there for a while, did some stuff, and then went back home to their careers and to their lives. They weren't going to just hand over their trust to me like I had earned it or something. They were going to make me work for it. They weren't going to just sit politely in my class and do their homework and raise their hands when I called on them and then engage whenever I felt like it into these spiritual, deep, thought-provoking discussions just because it was in my lesson plan for that day. It just wasn't going to happen. My 9th and 10th graders were particularly an adventure for me, and there were four young men in this class who I don't know if they got together at lunchtime. I don't know if they went home after school one day and had a little powwow, but they sort of made up their minds that they were going to try to do whatever they could to sabotage any spiritual conversations we could possibly have in the Bible class environment. And we would talk about the Bible, and I'd throw out this thought-provoking question, or what I thought and hoped was a thought-provoking question, and they would either give me nonsensical answers, or they would find a way to mock and embarrass the students who did try to answer the questions. Whenever I would try to do some kind of an activity, to get us thinking and maybe get us up and moving around the classroom just to try to learn in a tactile way, they would sabotage it so that it failed miserably. And they used to love to see how close they could get to being sent to the scary principal's office, who is in this room today. You probably feel afraid if you're sitting near him. Anyway, they loved it. And if they could get me upset, which happened very often, I would get sputtering. Have you ever been sputtering in the face of somebody that just did? And they just seemed to enjoy it when I got angry even more. It kind of got to the point where in the morning I'd get there to school first, and we'd be there, teachers early, we'd have our little devos and we'd do our thing. And as soon as the buses start to roll up to the school to let off these kids, and I see them get off the bus, like my heart started pounding. The adrenaline and the cortisol were being released in my body. It was slowing digestion. It was speeding up my heart rate. All the major blood flow is being shunted to major muscle groups. I mean, I was just tense from the very beginning of the day. And I'd be in class, and I'd be looking at where these four gentlemen are, and as if any of them would raise their hand or even open their mouth to speak. They might be yawning for all I know, and I would just be quick and nervous and upset and worried about what they were going to say next to make my life difficult. And for a full year, I felt like I was under attack, and I had to be on my guard at all times. I mean, I would go home after school, and I would just collapse on my couch, just exhausted from being on edge all day. It was honestly one of the most emotionally challenging times in my entire life. Here's a question for you. Have you ever felt like you've been under attack? Maybe somebody isn't going to harm you physically, but you're worried about the next hurtful comment that might come your way. Or maybe you don't hear any comments, but you feel people's eyes on you, judging you silently for some reason that you haven't quite figured out. Or maybe you've had someone spread a false rumor about you, damage your reputation in some way. If you've ever had somebody direct their anger or malice towards you, then you can understand the emotional roller coaster that can result from feeling like you are under attack. I mean, it can make us worried, can it? Easily angered, like we become like this time bomb, right? Just about ready to go off at any moment because we're so on edge. It can make us defensive and suspicious and always looking for the next threat that you have to be ready to respond to. Now, I told you last week that on this journey, this roller coaster journey through managing our emotions and relating to God in the midst of these up and down emotions, we were going to have a tour guide who was going to walk us through the journey of how to help manage these emotions God has given to us. And I told you that our tour guide was going to be David. And David, let me tell you, understood a lot about feeling under attack. I mean, this is a guy whose story gets started in the Bible, who becomes famous because a 9-foot Navy SEAL tried to kill him. Okay? I mean, he was a target for the baddest soldier of his day. He was the target. So he understands what it feels like to be under threat of bodily harm. I mean, his boss, the king, was so worried he was going to take his job, he decided to kill him and chase him for years, trying to hunt him down and kill him. Not only that, later on, after he becomes the king, you think everything settles down, right? Well, not exactly. His own kid, by the name of Absalom, decides to take away the kingdom from him and hunts his dad, trying to kill him. I mean, this is a guy who understands what it feels like to be threatened, to feel like he's under attack. He understands all these emotions. And what I love about God and what I love about the Bible is that David is going to write about these emotions in this beautiful book of the Bible, which is the ancient songbook of the Jewish faith called the Book of Psalms. What I'd like to do is I'd like to invite you to open your copy of the Bible to Psalm 36, where we're going to spend the rest of our time this morning. Psalm 36. I would invite you, if you didn't bring a copy of the Bible with you, to grab one of the Bibles that are in the chair right in front of you and open up to page 465. 465, that's where Psalm 36 is found. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at this psalm and ask ourselves the question, what do we do when we feel under attack? When we feel like somebody's coming after us to try to hurt us in some way, how do we respond? David is going to be our tour guide. And where we start in this psalm, strangely enough, or maybe not strangely enough, is he really takes a good hard look at the very real threat he was experiencing and feeling in his life. And it's in the first four verses of Psalm 36, which again, on page 465. You with me? Good. All right, here we go. Psalm 36, I'm going to read the first four verses. It says this: transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes. For he flatters himself in his own eyes that his iniquity cannot be found out and hate it. The words of his mouth are trouble and deceit. He has ceased to act wisely and do good. He plots trouble while on his bed. He sets himself in a way that is not good. He does not reject evil. Now, before we think that David is just having an interesting philosophical conversation about wicked people and what they're like, jump down to verse 11 and we'll realize that the wicked people he's describing are wicked people who are coming after David at that moment. Look at verse 11. Let not the foot of arrogance come upon me, nor the hand of the wicked drive me away. These people he's talking about in verses 1 through 4 are not just the wicked out there. Interesting philosophical discussion. They're people that are gunning for David right in that moment. Okay? So what are these people like who are coming after him? What does the attack look like that David is dealing with? Take a look at verse 1. It says, transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart. And then it says this: there is no fear of God before his eyes. This attacker who's coming after David is somebody who is not afraid of God. Now, have you ever noticed, drivers out there, that when you pass a cop car who's pulled somebody over, sometimes it encourages you to stay on the speed limit? I'm going to show the authorities of our nation that I take laws seriously, and I'm going to go 65. And then sometimes you think, the cop's already pulled somebody over. He's not waiting around the next bend for me. Woohoo, let's make up some lost time. Now, maybe that's none of you. Maybe that's just me on those weak moments in my life. But sometimes when we think that nobody's watching, we give ourselves permission to do things we would normally not do. What he's saying about the wicked person is, this person either doesn't believe God exists or doesn't believe God has any influence over world events or in his life. He has no fear of God. He acts the way he's going to act, and he doesn't care that God said no. That God said, don't do that. He has no fear of God. God is not somebody that makes him go, wow, I need to be careful. I need to manage my own activities. But keep going there. Verse 2 says this. He flatters himself in his own eyes that his iniquity cannot be found out. Not only does he think, there's no God to call me into account, nobody's going to know what I'm doing. How dangerous is somebody when they get that idea in their head? That no matter what they do, they're going to escape consequences. They're going to escape punishment. These are people who tend to just do whatever comes into their mind, and they can cause a lot of damage along the way. And David is experiencing that here in this psalm. And verse 3 talks about what kind of attack. Look at verse 3. It says, the words of his mouth are trouble and deceit. Whatever he's doing, part of the attack is verbal. I don't know if he's insulting David to his face. Probably not. He's probably slandering David, talking about David to other people. But regardless, the words of this wicked man's mouth are causing problems and are causing trouble for David. This attack he's experiencing is, at the very least, it's verbal and it's difficult for him to deal with. Look at verse 4. He plots trouble while on his bed. I mean, this is somebody who's so committed to doing something and causing damage in David's life. He lays in bed at night, and when he's trying to count sheep, he's plotting new ways to cause trouble for David. Now, I know in your most paranoid day, I hope you don't lay in bed at night worrying and wondering about what other people are plotting against you. But David apparently has gotten to that point with this wicked person, where he's like, this guy, he stays up at night to come up with new ways to trouble and cause problems for me in my life. It says he sets himself in a way that is not good. He does not reject evil. This is somebody who embraces evil with open arms. And this is the person that is attacking David in this psalm. Makes your heart pound a little bit if you have one of these people coming after you. I think it's really interesting. Scientists tell us that there's two general responses to feeling threatened. Have you heard about this? It's called the fight or flight response. When we're in a situation where we feel kind of backed into a corner, where somebody's coming after us, maybe it's physically or verbally or in some way trying to make us uncomfortable, we have two reactions. I'm going to add a third one that I think too in a minute. But the first one, this is obvious, right? This is the fight. You come after me, you're going to get it back worse, right? This is like when you walk into the break room and that person lobs that insult at you that really stings and everybody around kind of giggles. If you have the fight response, you come right back at that guy or girl with something even more witty and more painful, and you zing them right back. Then there's the flight response, right? The flight response is, I don't want to be here. I don't want to experience this. I can't handle this. This is too much. I'm too scared. This is freaking me out. I'm out of here. And so if you feel backed into a corner, feel like somebody's coming after you, you just avoid eye contact. So when you walk in the break room, somebody insults you, you just kind of turn right around. And you just go right back. Or you slink into a corner. You kind of, and then you move on because you don't want to deal with a conflict. I mean, this is too much to bear. The pressure and the stress bugs you that much. I want to add a third suggestion to you. Then there's the play dead mentality, right? The play dead. Yeah, I'm going to fight you. That's one option. I'm going to run away from you. That's the other option. And then the third one is, I'm just going to play dead. Okay. Haha, that's a funny joke, Mr. Break Man person. I'm so glad. And you almost pile on yourself because you don't want anybody else to pile on you. And so you just kind of give up and say, fine, whatever. And you hope that you ignore, or that at least people will not pay attention to you anymore. Now, here's the thing. Those are very normal ways of handling being threatened. Incredibly normal. As human as the day is long, right? But here's the problem. Those are not godly responses to being under attack. They're not healthy. Scientists and psychologists tell us, and just people with half a brain tell us, that if you approach feeling attacked in any of those three ways, you're just causing more problems. You know, the fighting instinct, we fight fire with fire. You know what happens? Everybody gets scorched around us. okay? And you know what we normally do is we usually overcompensate. We attack that person right back. What do they want to do in response? They want to attack us again, and it just starts this back and forth that can only end in misery for everybody. And flight. If you run away from everything your entire life, you'll miss out on relationships. You'll miss out on opportunities. You'll feel like a small, mousy person who doesn't have any kind of a say. You'll feel powerless, and it's just horrible. And if you play dead, you just kind of go along with it. Ha ha, it's funny. Kind of hope nobody pays attention to you. You just heap shame upon yourself, and you become somebody who's not an influencer of people. So these are not great responses. They're not godly responses. Now, things have changed a lot since David's day, which is about 3,000 years ago, okay? But I guarantee you, humans still tended to respond to conflict and to being attacked in one of those three ways. I mean, David could have responded in any of those three ways. I mean, is there a better fighter recorded in Scripture than David? I mean, if it's going to be a fight response, David could fight back better than anybody. He also had a lot of experience running away. If he wanted to escape and fly and hide, he could have done that as well. David probably wouldn't have done the play dead thing. It didn't seem his style. But in those days, David could have done that. But instead, in this psalm, in the rest of the psalm, we are going back to the psalm, don't worry. In the rest of this psalm, what David does is he lays out a very different kind of response to feeling attacked. And I think it's a biblical one. I think it's a healthy way to respond to these things. And so we're going to take a look at it. And I think if we can pay attention to how David responds to feeling attacked by this wicked person, we can learn from that and figure out how we can respond as well. Look at verse 5, please. Verses 5 and 6. Look what David says. Isn't it kind of an odd transition? Have you ever seen something in the Bible and you're like, oh, I think I understand what's happening. And then all of a sudden the next verse, you're like, huh? Like we want to feel, don't you want to feel when you read the Bible, like every time you read something, you're like, whoa. That was cool. I totally get that. I feel so enlightened right now. Like, don't we want to feel that way? I don't know about you. I read the Bible sometimes and I'm saying, huh? More than I'd like to admit. Because sometimes things are laid up next to each other in a way that is absolutely just strange. Look at this and ask yourself as we're reading this, does this seem to be a strange way to respond to the fact that I have an evil person trying to attack me? Look at verse 5. Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens. Your faithfulness to the clouds. Your righteousness is like the mountains of God. Your judgments are like the great deep. Man and beast you save, O Lord. He doesn't say anything about his situation, does he? He doesn't say anything about what he's planning to do to respond to these wicked people. In fact, he does the opposite of that. If you're following along in your notes, they're in your bulletin. If that helps you, great. Here's the first thing that David does. How should we respond to attacks? We need to stop reacting and remember who God is. Because here's the thing about our natural reactions when we're in the middle of this kind of a conflict attacking situation. Our normal instincts are almost always bad. Have you realized that when you just respond to something, you just react, the worst version of you shows up in that moment? I mean, our default setting is not kind and wise and patient. When I'm on edge and when I feel like somebody's coming after me, my first reaction is going to cause more problems. So I think the way we start this conversation is by saying this. When you're in that situation, you feel like you're being attacked, David would advise you, stop reacting. Okay, when we tell kids to stop, take deep breaths, count to 10. We look at little ones, right, that are going flipping out, and we realize there is some value in slowing down, thinking, breathing, stuff like that. Why do we as grown-ups think that that doesn't apply to us as well? We need it as much as kids do. We still are sometimes slaves of our natural reactions, and I'm telling you, friends, your natural reactions are driven by your fallenness, not by your godliness. So stop. Stop reacting. Don't assume that because somebody just came at me with something, I got to respond. No. Before you respond, before you do anything, please stop reacting, but remember who God is. See, this is not just some, you know, verse a day keeps the devil away, and I have my little Bible medicine pill for the day. Boop, you know, it's not that. It's learning to train your mind to bring the reality of who God is into your real life all the time. So that when I'm stressed and pressured, and I've got teenage boys that are trying to undermine my class, and it's really making me mad, I'm so connected to who God is, I respond out of that. And not respond out of my irritation. Not respond out of my insecurities. I respond out of who God is. And who is God, according to David? First of all, he's loyal and faithful, if you're following along in the blanks. He's loyal and faithful. Look at verse 5. Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Who is God? He's a God of steadfast love. Now, I know you guys think that I'm arranging all this so that I can talk about God's loyal love every single Sunday, and you're right. But here's the deal. God's loyal love is a big deal. The fact that he doesn't give up on you on any given day is really good news, is it not? The fact that we can rely upon a God who doesn't change how he feels about us based on our performance is sort of important. Now, when I lived in South America, almost everybody, like rich, poor, in between, most everybody had a dog, okay? And it wasn't just for the cute, warm fuzzies and the little selfies we can put on Facebook. It wasn't having a pet like that. In South America, where I lived, it was all about protecting your property. And so the bigger and the uglier and the scarier the dog, the better, right? I remember I'd go over to my friend's house, and these dogs have been trained to trust very few people. Their master's family, maybe, you know, but they've got one person who they trust that they're loyal to. Now, as long as I treat their family nicely and their family invites me into the house, guess what? Me and the dog get along great. I say a crossword. I climb over the fence when I'm not supposed to. I show up. I look threatening to that family. Guess how that dog approaches me? As a threat, and they take me seriously, and they will help me to not be a threat, right? Now, I'm not suggesting God is a watchdog, okay? But here's what I am suggesting. God is more loyal to you than any watchdog has ever been to any human person on the planet ever. When somebody comes after you, they're not coming after you, they're coming after God's kid. And that's a big difference. We don't have to scream to the heavens to get God to remember us and care about us. We have him. We have his heart. His loyal, steadfast love, it reaches to the heavens. There's no limit to it. You're like, okay, where does it stop? How far does it go? God's loyal, faithful love sticks with us. It's limitless. It abounds forever. Look at the next verse, verse 6. It says, your righteousness is like the mountains of God. Your judgments are like the great deep. Man and beast you save, O God. The second thing is about God we need to remember is he's right and he's fair. He's right and he's fair. His righteousness, that means how God measures up to the standard. Well, guess what? I got news for you. God is the standard. He doesn't have to measure up to it. He is it. His righteousness is higher than the tallest mountain, higher than Everest. You look up and you keep looking up and you keep looking up, and his righteousness, his fairness is there. And then it says his judgments are like the great deep. So you start looking your eyes all the way up to the sky as high as you can. You look all the way down deep as far as you can. God's judgments are everything in between. He is that great. He is that good. He is that awesome. And his judgments refer to his ability to be fair in his dealings with humanity, to help us to manage the things that are unfair. How unfair is it to come under attack from a wicked person or somebody who's not wicked but is acting wickedly in that moment? It's very unfair. That's why we get angry. That's why we're tempted to react in anger, because it's unfair. What he remembers about God is that God has judgments. God is the judge. These people that think they're acting and doing whatever they want to do, they have to answer to somebody. And that somebody is God, whose judgments are in the very depths of the earth. God is keeping track. God is faithful. God is loyal to us. He is right and he is fair. When you're having somebody coming after you, you've got to remember that about God. God is not siding with the abuser. God is not siding with injustice just because he doesn't move to act as quickly as you would like. He in heaven is also offended by the unfairness of what just happened. His judgments are as deep as the depths of the earth. And then the last thing I see, look at this, this is crazy. Man and what? Beast you save, O God. God is, the last thing on the notes there, he's a rescuer by nature. Now, what this seems to imply is that God takes an active role in the affairs of the animal kingdom as he does the active role in the affairs of humanity. Now, does that mess with you? I mean, the next time a squirrel runs out in front of your car and narrowly escapes the crushing weight of your wheels, does it encourage you to think that maybe God put a little burst of wind behind that little guy to get him by in time? Now, I know God doesn't always do that. Sadly, I have evidence every day when I drive that that doesn't always happen. But the truth is that God is portrayed as somebody who takes an active involvement in the affairs of even the animals. It's like Jesus was saying, if God takes care of the birds, if God takes care of the lilies of the field that are here today and gone tomorrow, like literally, how's he not going to take care of you? How's he not going to come to your rescue? See, when I'm here and I have somebody attacking me, I feel like I gotta fix this. I've gotta stop this from happening. I've gotta make this right. And what I need to do in that moment is not react, is to stop and go, whoa, 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 whoa. Deep breath, one, two, count it, whatever, 10,000 if you have to, but count, calm down. I have a God who's on my side. I have a God who's loyal to me. I have a God who is right and fair. I have a God who is a rescuer by nature. If I'm in trouble, I can count on him. He's going to be around. He's not going to have, you know, the busy signal when I give him a call. He is here. He saves men and even the beasts. We can all count on him and his rescuing nature. But it doesn't stop there. We don't just remember who God is. We remember something else. We remember this. I'm going to have you write it down, and then we'll talk about it. Remember the blessings of being with God. Don't just remember who God is. That's great. But don't forget, take some time in that moment to remember the blessings that come from being in a relationship with God. Look at verses 7 through 9. He says this, "How precious is your steadfast love, O God. The children of mankind take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light do we see light." What are the blessings of God, the blessings of being in a relationship with God? David starts off with the first one. He protects me. The children of mankind, verse 7 says, take refuge in the shadow of your wings. If you've ever heard the teachings of Jesus, you might remember a time when he was calling out to the people of Jerusalem, and he said, Jerusalem, how many times I wanted to call you to myself and shelter you like a hen protects her baby chicks. And he says, but you were not willing. That's the image here, the shadow of God's wings. It pictures God as a mother bird, scooping all of her little ones under her wings so that anybody who wants to get at her babies has to go through mama. Nobody wants to have to get through mama, right? Nobody does. That's where we are. When we're in a relationship with God, we can take refuge. That means we can hide. We can find a place where we can be safe under the shelter of his wings. You're not out there all by yourself. You're not out there vulnerable, huh? Nobody's here to take. You are not an orphan. You're a child of God who wants to shelter you and give you refuge like a mother bird gives to her babies. But it gets better, or at least more complete. Not only does he protect me, but he provides me with more than enough. Take a look at verse 8. They feast on the abundance of your house. You know how David could have said that? They get their 3 square meals a day, right? And that would be fine, right? We ate 3 good meals a day. It's not what the text says, does it? They feast. You want to feast? Come to our next little shindig out here in the activity center we have sometime. We eat, and we eat plenty. That's the idea. When we come to God for provision, when we say, God, I need help, I need something, he doesn't just say, okay, here's a little eyedropper of blessing. Bloop. He pours his blessing on us. We feast on the abundance of God's house. And then I love this phrase, you give them drink from the river of your delights. Wow. That phrase is so pregnant with meaning and thoughts and ideas. The river of God's delights. God invites you, hey, come on over here. Come on over here. You want a drink of water? I'm not going to give you a drink of water. I'm going to let you go right down to the river of my joy, the river of my delight. And I want you to just put your head in the water and just drink as much as you can. It won't diminish the river for you to drink from it. And it'll satisfy you. God provides us with more than enough. When somebody's attacking us, we always feel like we're operating out of a position of need or scarcity. Like, I don't have enough, and they're hurting me. They're attacking me. And God says, no, I can take care of you. I can give you what you need. This person out there who's attacking you, they don't make the decision about whether or not you're okay. I make that decision. I take care of you. You can feast on the abundance of my house, and you can drink from the fountain or the river of your delights, of God's delights. He provides me with more than enough. A third thing he does, look at verse 9. It says, for with you is the fountain of life. What do I think that means? I think it means this. He preserves and renews my life. You ever need a little boost? My car sometimes, not lately, thank the Lord, but I had a problem with my car with my battery. And it just, maybe I left a light on. Whatever. But it would just stop working one day. I'd go to work and, or nothing. You know what that car needs? It needs to have its life renewed, doesn't it? It needs a jump, literally. You attach the cables, bada boom, bada bing, I have no idea how it works, but then all of a sudden, like magic, your car can ride again. It's had its life source renewed. Now, David was a guy who was familiar with the desert. He used to hide from the king in the desert. And so he understood something about water. Water equals life, right? No water, very quickly, no life. And so what David is saying is this, if you find a fountain in the desert, do you know what that is? That's not just a water hole that could dry up. A fountain is some kind of, it's fed by some kind of underground source. And the fountain keeps bubbling up new water. It is an everlasting source of life for people going through the desert. That's why they had wells, it was a big deal. And here he says, in you, verse 9, with you is the fountain of life. God, you're like that ever-bubbling thing that comes up. And I'm tired, and I'm worn out, and I feel attacked, and I feel beaten down, and I feel low, and I feel hurt. And God says, let me give you some more. Let me give you some more life. Let me boost back into your life. Let me just bubble up and give you, again, water to refresh your soul and your body. Let me be that for you. And David is like, man, God preserves my life. He renews my life. And then I love the last phrase in verse 9. In your light do we see light. How does God, what's the blessings of being with God? The blessing is that he guides us. Isn't it terrifying to be in the dark and not know where you're going and have no way to find the light switch? I remember the first time I came downstairs here in the youth room down there. I don't remember if one of my kids shut off the light early or maybe it was my own fault. I turned off the light too soon and I was plunged in darkness in that room down there. There are obstacles down there. There are things that want to trip you up. Like, it's not quite like a T-Rex jumping out at you, but there's some stuff. If you're not careful, you're going to trip and fall and hurt yourself. Light brings hope, doesn't it? And all of a sudden there's guidance. Oh, I don't have to stumble my way through here. If I walk straight down the middle, I can get to the door without hurting myself. Don't you need guidance in life sometimes? Need somebody to show you what to do, which way to go? David's stopping and he's not reacting to the person trying to attack him. He's remembering, oh, right. I'm in a relationship with God. I don't have to just react and protect myself and defend myself and take care of myself. I have God. I don't know what to do. Somebody hurts me and I don't know how to respond. In his light, I have my light. Because God knows what to do. He can communicate with me through his word, through his spirit, through his people, and I can figure out what to do. I'm not alone. I'm not abandoned. I'm not an orphan. I know I'm hurting right now and I'm being attacked, and that's not cool. It's not cool to God either. But God is the one I need to turn to. And so David decides, okay, I'm going to stop reacting. I'm going to remember who God is. I'm going to remember his blessings. But now I've got to do something, right? Just remembering, that's just, you know, that's not doing anything. What do we do about it? Take a look at verse 10 and 11 of Psalm 36. David says this, "Oh, continue your steadfast love to those who know you, and your righteousness to the upright of heart. Let not the foot of arrogance come upon me, nor the hand of the wicked drive me away." After he takes a few minutes to stop, breathe, calm down, and remember who God is and the blessings of being in a relationship with God, he finally gets around to doing something about his problem. Up till now, he's just helping himself think it through. Now he's going to do something. And what is he going to do? Very simple in your notes. He's crying out to God for his deliverance. You're like, really? That's his strategy? Yep. But they're coming after me. They're attacking me. Don't I have to defend myself? David says, maybe. But I think what he's really saying is, you got somebody else to defend you. You need to cry out to him first, at the very least, before you take any other action, before you say anything. You need to cry out to God for his deliverance. Now, I love verse 10. Verse 10 is really funny. It says, "Oh, continue your steadfast love to those who know you." It's like he's saying to God, "God, don't ever change." Have you ever, I don't know if they still do this anymore, but when I was in high school and junior high, we would get the yearbook at the end of the year. Right? You should hopefully get it a few days beforehand, and we'd take it to school, and we'd have all our little friends write us little messages, and "You're so cool, and I think you're funny, and you're great," and then this would invariably make it into 97.8%, it's a rough estimate, of the comments in the yearbook. "Don't ever change. Stay the same." In other words, the idea is, I like you, I want to keep liking you next year, so over the summer, please don't turn into an idiot. You know, it's basically what this message is saying. Stay the same. Don't ever change. He's doing that to God. He's saying, "God, I remember your steadfast love. Please don't stop that. Please continue it. Keep it going. Please don't ever change. Please be the God you've always been. You were the God of Abraham, Isaac, and be my God too." Kids and young people, I'll let you decide if you're in the group or not. God can be the God of your mom and dad, but he needs to be your God too. It's not good enough. Mom and dad's God does not cut it when you're getting attacked by evil people. You need your God to come to the rescue. You need to say, "God, continue that steadfast love. I know you've taken care of people in the past. I've got evidence in the scriptures and in my own life. God, be my God too. Take care of me too. Be faithful and steadfast to me." So what does he do? The first thing he does is he appeals to God's character. He says, "God, I know what you're like. I know who you are. God, stay that way for me in my trouble." And then the last thing is he just asks for what he needs. Did you notice that? Look at verse 11. "Let not the foot of arrogance come upon me, nor the hand of the wicked drive me away." He knows the wicked is out, the wicked person is out to hurt him and even to drive him away, to crush him. He says the foot of arrogance, the idea there is somebody on the ground and trampled under the feet of their enemy. You know, you picture the old gladiators from the old days, right? They finally conquer their enemy, but he's not dead yet. They push him down on his back, they put a foot on his chest, and they look up to Caesar for the thumbs up, thumbs down. That's kind of the idea here. The foot of arrogance. God, don't let me be defeated by the arrogant. God, don't let me be crushed or driven away by the hand of the wicked. That's what he's come all this way. He finally gets down to asking God for what he needs. Guys, friends, brothers and sisters, it's okay to ask God for what you need. Now, if all we do is come to God and say, "God, I want this, God, I want this, God, I want this," then obviously that kind of makes the relationship out of whack. But if you started by remembering who God is, you've started by remembering how great it is to be in a relationship with God, and you appeal to God's character, then you do what David did. Say, "I need help. I need help. And maybe that's hard for you. Maybe it's hard to get to that point where you're like, you know what, God? I can't solve this problem. Maybe it's because you've had some success with the fight or flight. I've made my life work pretty good so far by screaming people down whenever they come after me. By humiliating and mocking and manipulating other people. That's kind of worked for me so far, God. Or you know what, God, I keep my head down and people don't notice me and I kind of am able to sneak away and I don't often get into a lot of trouble, God. I don't really need your help. David says, I need God's help. I could fight, I could run away. But that's not going to get me what I need. I need God to show up and do something that I can't do. Guys, friends, that's called the life of faith. It's a life of dependence upon God. You probably don't like feeling weak. I don't like it either. I hate it. I'd much rather manage my life in such a way that I don't need God that much. Only for the really big stuff, whatever that means. God wants us to be children of His who don't get intimidated by the attacks, don't get, but they also don't react. They stop, they think, they remember Him. They remember the blessings of being in a relationship with God, and then they just cry out to God for deliverance. God, rescue me. Please rescue me. I'm telling you, friends, if you do, if you embrace that, and it's hard, but if you embrace that life of faith, that life of dependence upon God, don't be surprised if in your story, verse 12 happens to you. And this is how David concludes his song. He says this, there the evildoers lie fallen. They are thrust down, unable to rise. Now, the text is a little bit ambiguous. It's written grammatically in such a way that it's almost like it's happening in front of his eyes at the moment. It's like a continual process. He's not writing this song after the battle is over. It's almost like he's writing it while the battle is happening. It's happening right in front of him. He's expressing his faith to God, and then at the very end, he goes, oh my word, I just prayed, and look at that. There's the evildoer. He's lying fallen. They can't get up. They can't attack me. God showed up. If we don't follow this process, if we just lash out, if we just fight or flight or lie dead, we never get to see God rescue. And yes, I get it. In order for God to rescue, you've got to be in trouble. So who wants that, right? But friends, trouble is going to come whether you find it or run away from it or not. When trouble comes, and it does come, when we refuse to react, we find that God steps in and intervenes. And may each one of you, here's what I pray for me, and here's what I pray for you. As you are attacked, and it'll happen, sometimes it's friends who attack us, and sometimes it's people from outside, and people who don't even know us, but an attack is an attack. When you feel that attack, it's so tempting to just want to fight back, or to run away, or to lie dead and escape people's attention. But when we embrace a life of faith that says, God, I'm going to remember you in this moment. I'm going to remember how great it is to be in a relationship with you, and I'm going to cry out to you and wait for your deliverance. We will have stories to tell our children of God showing up. And when God shows up, you'll never forget it. You'll never forget it. So as you manage these emotions, God's there. He's not silent. He's not abandoned you. Don't just react. Remember God and then cry out to Him for help. Let's pray.